Hi everyone, my name is Bushra and I am the host of Ignite the Change, a podcast focused on the professional journey of some really wonderful and brilliant therapists. I wanted to start this podcast episode a little bit differently. I promise you'll hear about Sahar and her story soon, but I cannot upload this as is without acknowledging the continued genocidal attacks on the Palestinian people. If you've been paying attention, we have seen the tears and heard the cries of children who have lost their parents, the women and men who are struggling to find their children in the rubble. You have seen the images of body parts scattered, and you have seen the Palestinian people continue to pray amongst the destruction around them. You'll hear Sahar and I discuss the genocidal attacks on the Palestinian people briefly, and in fact, she is one of the numerous therapists that I've talked to since October 7th that is advocating for a free Palestine. Future therapist, this is your job too. Your job, part of it, is to fight for the well-being of others. And I know what we are seeing online can be overwhelming. But that is the very least that we can do, to watch, to listen to the cries, and then to continue to protest, call representatives, and most importantly, to continue to pray for peace around us and around the world. I truly hope that you all enjoy this episode with Sahar. Like Sahar says, we are seeing things differently in today's world. And I truly hope and pray that because of that, we can then see change in a way we've never seen before. May Palestine be liberated. May the countries and the communities that are facing the same atrocities be heard, be seen, and be freed from the pain. Some therapists could tell you they were born for this career. I think my guest Sahar is one of those people. Sahar is an associate marriage and family therapist and associate professional clinical counselor. As a second-generation South Asian of Pakistani and British descent who grew up in the UAE, Sahar is a third culture kid who is passionate about supporting clients to heal from intergenerational trauma and recognize how the cycles show up in their lives. Sahar practices from an anti-oppressive, trauma-informed lens and supports individuals and couples in California to connect with themselves to gain a sense of empowerment within and facilitate meaningful connections with others. I am so excited for all of you to hear Sahar's story and how she found comfort in a therapist's chair. Welcome to Ignite the Change. I'm your host, Bushra. I'm a licensed clinical social worker working as a mental health therapist in private practice. Before private practice, I worked with first-generation high school and college students across the city and suburbs of Chicago as they navigated their education and careers. My passion will always be with the student and their experience. Ignite the Change is a space where we're able to hear from talented mental health clinicians as they share how they navigated this profession. You'll hear stories of identity, family, education, and more. Through powerful conversations, I believe we can ignite change in the mental health field, and more importantly, inspire the next generation of clinicians to find comfort in the therapist's chair.
It's so wonderful to have you, Sahar. I'm so excited to talk to you today.
Thank you so much for having me here. I'm excited to be a part of it.
Yeah, I know that you sent me a summary of the type of therapist you are and what you do. And I'm so curious to learn more about this third culture kid perspective that you have. Usually I start these podcasts out by asking the same question to various guests. And I just want to know, where does your story of becoming a therapist begin? Is there a certain moment that you had that drew you to this field, event that occurred, a thought that you had, an idea that you had that drew you to this career?
So I think, you know, going back, sort of activism and this idea of being in service to community was very like integrated into my upbringing. So from hearing stories of my dada, who was very involved in community and social activism, to, you know, for on Eid, when we'd collect our Eidi at the end, my mom would be like, okay, how much would you like to donate or to send to Pakistan for kids?
Wow. Wow.
It was kind of always there. And I love to read autobiographies about people's stories as a kid and just interested in their own experiences and kind of what made them who they are. And then always interested in, you know, issues, whether it be IPV or women's rights issues or human trafficking or what led people to addiction. These were always things that were on my mind, even from when I was really young. And so it's always like being in service in some way and to be able to create some social change.
You're saying something that's ringing some bells for me. Can you, if you don't mind, sharing a little bit about how perhaps your grandparents, maybe specifically your dada, I'm not sure yet, how their activism got you where you are or started that trend in your life of being an activist?
So this, just from hearing stories, I never met my dada. He passed before I was born, but there's always, you know, stories about the work that he did and how he brought, you know, education and spread awareness of education for all genders in areas in Pakistan where there was no access to education. So this idea of like pursuing, that's why when I did, you know, wanted to do my master's, it was very supported because education has been so integral in our family and providing opportunities in that way. And I think what I mentioned on this like new, you know, it's in progress, Instagram page, the Chai Circles, is sort of what led me into this aspect of how intergenerational trauma shows up. And so my Nana is a survivor of the partition of 1947. And we have both Pakistani and British, you know, of course, Indian before Pakistan was formed, ancestry within us. And so that sort of led me into this area of self-exploration during my master's and doing research papers on the partition and the effects of it and how that trauma shows up.
Tell me more about in your research, because I actually don't know, and shame on me for not knowing about.
There's such limited research out there. I think like one thing that I found was that I know there's a lot of people, especially now, providing more information, but actually publish, you know, people have done it as, you know, their PhD papers and their dissertations, but actually published research. I think there's such a gap still. And there's so much space for others to come in and say, hey, this is our story. And this is what we found. And this is what we see as continuing to go on in our communities. And there's also this echo of silence for survivors who it might be too traumatic, too painful to share.
Would you mind sharing a little bit about your Nana's experience?
Yeah, so he was really little when partition took place. So I actually grew up like every summer we'd visit him. And I was probably too young to even, I shouldn't have been in the room hearing some of these stories, I think, but it was so meaningful for him to be able to share what he experienced. So Nana, his mother was British, his father was Indian, and they had to flee from, they were in Punjab, and they had to flee, and they ended up going over to what is now Karachi. I mean, I have like footage and information of some of what he has shared because it was important for me to be able to document it. I think of what to share because there are so many stories of what he witnessed, of how he had to act a certain way so that people may not question whether he was Muslim or not, you know, going on the train and trying to survive while seeing all of the bloodshed. And of course, it was from all sides. I mean,
Right. It's a, you know, and I guess the reason why I wanted to kind of talk about that, and I'm so grateful for the information that you have shared, is because you really don't hear about it. And perhaps if I really think about, do we hear much about, you know, the effects of colonization in general and how it affects people?
You know, there is a resource, I believe it's 1947 Partition Archives online, and they've done a lot of work in collecting stories of people who'd like to share. But it's kind of kept. It's information. And I mean, I imagine there was so much destruction of records that may have existed, right? Because that's the way to keep those who are oppressed oppressed and not account or provide any reparations for what has occurred. So it's got stories of, you know, I believe it was his grandmother hiding. There was like an empty well where they lived and nobody knew there wasn't water in the bottom of the well, but she put him in a bucket and they climbed down.
Right.
And her family was essentially killed upstairs, and she just grabbed him because at least she could grab him. And when everyone was gone, you know, they assumed there was no, the well was empty, so they didn't look down. And so then they climbed up and she carried him and they went on their way.
Do you work with trauma survivors?
I do. Yeah. Trauma is one area of client work. Yeah, working with clients. So I provide EMDR and all care, sort of trauma informed.
Yeah. So it was the activism of sounds like various members of your family.
Yeah, I think so. Yeah.
That led you to becoming a therapist. It sounds like that was a foundation, a point of foundation, I guess, a piece of the foundation that led you to this. Wow. I don't hear that often, that it is, that if we were to go back in time, and was it, your grandparents are, this isn't like a distant relative that's experienced this.
Yeah.
I hope that you feel empowered to continue the work that you're doing. Can you share a little bit about, I guess, aside from the activism, specifically therapy, and sitting, you know, in the therapist's chair and feeling like, wow, this is a place that I want to be. Was it because of the activism that goes into working with clients one-on-one? Or is there something more that drew you to therapy specifically?
You know, a friend actually from high school, while I was in my master's program, reminded me, she's like, oh, you're doing what you always wanted to do. I was like, what? What do you mean? She said that we once had a career fair at school and I had asked, you know, we didn't know what, growing up in the UAE, we didn't really know the terms. I knew what a psychiatrist was. You know, we had counselor at school, but really didn't know what a therapist was. There just wasn't that awareness. And so a friend reminded me, she's like, yeah, we had a career fair and you asked if there's like some sort of counselor or someone who works with families because you wanted to help kids by helping their parents, by working with their parents to support their children. And, you know, I'm a child of divorce. And, you know, that's also something in our communities that's very stigmatized. And my parents were able to put aside their own differences. And till today, they remain very good friends.
Yeah.
And we see examples of this, I think, as well across the South Asian community.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think it's a bit of the personal, you know, comes in. And through sort of my own journey of healing and realizing, like, you don't have to feel alone. Mm-hmm. We go through so many things where we may feel alone. And mm-hmm. what is that like to have someone see you, to witness you in your struggle?
Mm-hmm.
Able to lean on that support. I think also in our communities, there's so much of this, like, don't share what happens in the household outside. You know, there's this phrase like ghar ki baat, which is when you do something for somebody, you know, it's like, oh, don't worry. Like if you do a favor, or it's a way to appreciate, like, you don't have to repay me or redo the favor. But there's also this ghar ki baat, don't share what goes on outside. And so how, you know, to be able to share and to build trust between people in our communities, we connect through sharing our experiences. I think about this even in working with like BIPOC clients in the therapy room, you know, this idea of the therapist as a blank slate doesn't work. How do you build connection and trust? I guess going back to what led me here is after high school, I sort of went through, you know, I did undergrad in sociology and tried a bunch of different majors. Nothing stuck, but I always...
Did you go the med school, the pre-med?
I didn't. I didn't, the medical engineering. I went to business first. I forgot about this aspect, I think, in high school of, you know, counseling or whatever that could look like. And so I decided to go into business and it didn't stick with me. There was no passion in it. And so then I tried a bunch of different majors. I went into communications. I went into international affairs and I took an addictions and society class. And after that, I chose sociology as my major. And
wow, it sounds like you wanted to make an impact from the beginning of time. Like, you know, when you were little, you knew you wanted to do something that would make an impact.
I think so. Like, yeah, connecting with others.
That's amazing to hear, Sahir. I'm wondering, I do want to dive into this third culture kid concept. Can I ask you where you were born?
I was born in California. My parents were all in the UAE at the time. My nani and nana lived in California, so my mom actually came here. It was just like 6 months before the Gulf War occurred.
Oh, I
see.
I was born in California, raised in Dubai, and then left for after high school. Gone back in between, but that's a long, interesting, like this third culture kid aspect when someone asks you, where are you from?
Yeah.
You know, this aspect of identity and what that means. The short answer is I'm Pakistani, but there's a longer answer there. So how much time do you have?
So, question for you. I actually don't know much about being a third culture kid. And I'm sure there's someone that's going to be listening to this and being like, what does that even mean? Can you break that down? Can you give us a definition of what that looks like?
There is a like an actual definition. What it means to me is more growing up in a culture that isn't where you, what your ethnicity is. That's kind of what it means to me. Like, you know, I say I'm Pakistani. I've never lived in Pakistan.
Right.
You know, but I'm also part British because my mom's part British. So yeah, it's this aspect. There's more to it. There's more cultures. And growing up in the UAE, you know, back then it was very community based. It was, I'm a melting pot of culture and all different walks of life and different backgrounds. And so you sort of take on this third, yeah, an additional culture where, you know, there's like this unspoken, when I meet other third culture kids or, you know, other expats who grew up in the UAE, and there's like this unspoken identity of, you understand, I don't know, there's this piece of connection. And it's, I often find in a laugh when it's the question of where are you from? And there's a hesitation because it's literally, how much time do you have? So it's sort of this other culture that happens. You grow up in the environment that isn't your nationality, ethnicity, whatever those
it's
you.
A story and a long one.
Yes, a long one.
So now, do you work primarily with South Asian clients?
That's
or
my,
do you have a diverse group of people?
It's a mix currently. I am, you know, as I move into, I'm an associate, so on the way to licensure, but that's sort of the direction that I'm going into, and that's something that I've been interested in for a while now. But also, you know, more generally, immigrants and other BIPOC communities. But yes, I would like to predominantly work with South Asian community and Muslim community as well.
I was going to say, Sahir, the reason why I asked that was because, you know, as a therapist who works with a lot of South Asian clients, I feel like the concept of identity comes up a lot.
Mm-hmm.
Granted, I don't think I have ever worked with any third culture clients before, but even them having Indian or Pakistani parents and growing up in America, there's that identity struggle. I can't imagine what it was like for you. I have a lot of empathy for you. And yeah, I just wonder if that's something that you see in a lot of your clients, this idea of trying to figure out their identity and where they belong.
I think so. That's a lot of the work that I'm finding underlies it. And I mean, coupled with a lot of, you know, how does that, this aspect of where you belong while you're trying to reconcile the experiences that you've had that you didn't choose for yourself.
Were your parents approving of your profession of voice? Oh gosh, she's smiling, guys.
When it now, yes, is the short answer. The longer answer is that I didn't share. When I applied to grad school, you know, I think in my immediate family unit were quite independent, and I didn't share because it sort of came into alignment. I wasn't living in California at the time when I applied to grad school, and finding the program through someone who was attending the university I chose, it sort of just came into alignment. I was thinking about doing my master's. I wasn't sure in what, and heard about this program, and I was like, that's it. Looked it up, and so I applied, and this was also around the time of the pandemic, so sometimes memories are a little blurred, you know.
3 years feels like it was like 8 years.
Yeah, definitely. So I shared once I was accepted to the university. Once I got in, I did share, and they were very proud. Again, like this aspect of, you know, I was like, you know, continue your education, be that independent woman. Of course, there's always that like, I want to see you settled. And, you know, all that comes in with in Desi family.
Marriage.
Yeah. But at the same time, they're very proud. And my dad was like, yeah, do it. He's very much of like, you know, if I have an idea, he's like, why not? My mom's a little more fear-based sometimes, you know, why? Or she wonders, she worries how things will be done. So they were very supportive once I got in. I don't think they truly, like, and how can they fully understand what it is, you know, what it means, like what, also this idea of like, we don't see therapists. We don't, you know, Desi communities, what is a therapist? What do they do?
They just talk.
Yeah. I think they understand it a lot more now and have, you know, they've been very supportive throughout the process though. I will say that. I think there was more fear once they had like shared how proud they were and like, you know, excited that I am continuing my education. It was more like, okay, how are you going to support yourself? You're going to live alone? You're going to move to California? Like, what's going on? So that all came in and sometimes continues to go through. You know, I live far away from family and it's been interesting navigating through it on my own.
Can I ask you what master's program you decided on settling on?
So it was a master's in clinical psychology at Antioch University in LA.
Okay.
Very social justice focused school.
Which you don't use. I mean, I might stand corrected, but I don't think you see that usually in counseling programs being social justice based. I might be wrong with that.
Yeah, I mean, I didn't do much research into different programs, to be honest. This kind of came, I think years ago, but I still wasn't sure of like what master's program I would want. I looked psychiatry. I knew that more medical wasn't for me, that more medical route. But yeah, I will say though, for those entering the field and choosing their programs, even if like a place is social justice oriented, you know, question what you're learning, you know, and who you're learning from, especially during this time. If you're walking into a classroom and your professor isn't willing to open up space to speak about ongoing genocide, what's happening in Gaza, what's happening, what has been happening, right, in Sudan, in Congo, in different areas of the world, which I think growing up in the Middle East, we've been very aware of from a very young age. The way we are witnessing it now is different. The scale to which these aren't new issues. And so question, I think, and speak out. You know, it's not always safe, and it may not always feel safe. But take note of who you're learning from as well.
Long gone are the days that we even trust our teachers. Did you feel like your university or your program was open to continuously to learn? Did you feel like your teachers were trustworthy? Or were there moments where you struggled with what was taught to you?
Oh, yeah. Definitely. For me personally, I learned in my program, I wanted to learn from, you know, professors who are clinicians of color. Mm-hmm. That was meaningful to me. Not that I can't learn from white people. Not that there's information to be shared, you know, and knowledge to be gained. But it was important to me because I think that there is some aspect of a shared experience in what it means, clinician of color. I, you know, in private practice, I actually, my couples counseling professor is who is my private practice supervisor. Again, it sort of all came into alignment. So there was, and we were, I think, in most, I'd say most of my professors would share that, you know, question what you're learning as well. Does it apply to our community? But that's not all. You know, that's not all. That's somewhat of what I experienced. I experienced both.
Let me ask you, because I worked in education for a little bit during the Trump years, and I worked predominantly with Black and Brown students. And there were times where students would come to me and be like, Bushra, this professor said this, and it didn't sit well with me. And it was something about different world events happening. And what would you say to a student that is struggling with what a teacher is saying or how they're teaching a certain unit? If they're sitting in that discomfort, do they stay silent? I mean, I think there's so many ways that we could go with this topic. I mean, I think safety is also something to definitely be considered. But I guess what would you tell them? Because it probably has happened to all of us.
What comes to mind is first get support, right? Ideally, you'd be able to speak up, you'd share, you'd speak to that professor, or if you need to, support from admin or whatever that looks like. But initially, is get support, find a safe person to be able to share that with of what's going on and sort of have a sounding board there to support you in what you're experiencing in that moment. I am very outspoken, so I think so. I am
like, I would be up there right away.
Yeah, I'd be like, you know, I would speak. I am the person in family who brings up topics that nobody wants to discuss or that, you know, needs to be, and it makes people uncomfortable. I do that with friends as well, you know, that in my close circles, and I would say something.
So this might be a personal question just for me. We can edit this out if you feel uncomfortable by it, but is that just part of your personality, or did you become that way, that outspoken?
I've always been this way. I think the aspect of, I was always the kid who would, like, I'd question, like, what if, you know, I'd ask, you know, family, older family members, like, oh, what if this happened? How would you react? Or what would you do? And I've just been always curious about, I think that goes so much in the way people think, like the way they, what is their perspective on things? And, you know, like even going back to the aspect of, you know, not really sharing much about the program when I was applying or having other input, because it felt so alignment. Like my trust in a higher power is there as well, feeling guided in my decisions. And of course, there's always wisdom to be gained from others. But when you feel right in your decisions, you know, I didn't want anybody to say, oh, I don't know. We sometimes say not nuzzer, but, you know, like just didn't want external influences. My dad will say, you know, he'll be like, well, I'm glad you shared something with me, but Sahar is Sahar, like you're going to do what you want. Not that I can't receive guidance or input, but when I sort of have my mind on something, you know, if I feel that it's right, I'll go for it.
So this ties into what you're saying, and let me see if I can kind of ask you this question in an organized way. I've been thinking a lot about how, you know, our work doesn't just stop in the office in which we sit in. It is, I mean, we are activists in some ways, perhaps in a lot of ways. But a lot of people, a lot of clinicians, you know who you are, have been very silent about what's happening in Gaza, what's happening in Sudan, what's happening in Congo, what's happening elsewhere in the world, the terrible things that are occurring in our country, in the United States, and elsewhere, have stayed silent. And that has rubbed me the wrong way. But then I think about the student that's maybe struggling to speak up to their teacher, and how that future student might be the same student that gets, you know, the same clinician that gets online and decides to start an Instagram page and then remain silent. I guess, and this is more of like a conversation point, but when is it just not appropriate to stay silent in our profession? When is it not okay to just be comfortable in the therapist's chair and that's all that you do? And maybe that's not something that, Sahar, you can answer. Maybe that's just a question for everyone else. But it's just, it's so bizarre to me. And I went to, I got my master's in social work, went to Jane Addams at UIC, very social justice based. So this concept of remaining silent, this idea of remaining silent, I don't understand it.
I feel the same way. I feel, you know, as you're talking, I notice my own sense of frustration and where it sits within me. And I also, you know, simply, it's not okay. That's, you know, the feeling within. And I do recognize that there are other ways to be active outside of social.
You are a lot kinder than me because you are right. I forgot about it.
I think I myself I'm still trying to make sense of it. You know, is that, I mean, I know even within me, I keep a personal Instagram, and like I have started the Chai Circles, and I'm much more active on my personal than on Chai Circles. It's, I have a wider, I mean, you know, this is something new. I have a larger community on my personal Instagram. And so I'm constantly sharing there. And there are other spaces to bring up conversation, to raise awareness, to amplify Palestinian voices, to not only Palestinian voices, but, you know, right, especially with what's happening in Gaza. There are other ways to contribute to raise awareness. But if the conversations are only happening also amongst people who have the same viewpoint, as important as it is to demonstrate, to protest, to do all these things, there has to be cross conversation.
And I think that what you're saying right now is key, that that's what's important, to have cross conversations. Like, it's great to silently boycott certain brands. It's great to tiptoe to, you know, maybe certain events, certain protests. But at one point, I think what you're saying is that we have to actually broaden who we're speaking to.
And if you, as a therapist, if you have a platform, even if it's not however many people or whatever it is, right? And, you know, I think there's a lot of fear around like losing clients and continuing business as usual. How is business, you know, how are you living life business as usual? What's happening in our world? And if you have a space, if you can plant a seed, even 1% in a Zionist mind, that seed continues to grow, or they have a conversation of frustration with somebody that they know. And then that leads to, I don't know, I like to think that there's endless possibilities. Maybe that's my own need to like have some sense of hope when things can feel so helpless and so hope. There's always spaces in which conversations can continue. And if you are a therapist who is silent right now, if you have a platform and you're not using it, yeah, that doesn't sit right with me.
It doesn't sit right with me either. Because then I have to wonder, are you as trauma-informed as you make it out to be? I'm sure your clients are bringing something up, whether that is, regardless of the point of view, I'm sure they've brought something up.
And if they're not, are you also creating a space that's actually open to discussing issues that might be on your client's mind?
How often do you and your clients talk about politics in session?
Isn't that also what we've been taught, right? From like a very, that's part of decolonizing therapy. It's whatever they want to share. It's the room is open for that. If they don't feel like they can discuss their politics, doesn't that intertwine with your morals and values as a human? Isn't that an intersection of your identity? And if your clients don't feel comfortable to bring that to you, what does that mean within, within the therapeutic relationship, within connecting on a human level?
That they can't even bring this up to you, their therapist.
There's more to it than that, right? I think.
Yeah. You know, this is making me think of, I've heard this multiple times now, Sahar, that people are either in supervision at their private practice that they work at, or maybe they have a therapist, and that therapist has in one way or another caused a little bit of a break in the relationship because they may not understand what's happening in Gaza, or they're not open to discussing it, or they have made their side clearly known, whether that is to remain neutral or not, to not have much empathy for the people of Gaza. Since Ignite the Change is for students entering the field or clinicians in general, I mean, how do we handle those spaces? Do we decide to leave our therapists? Do we decide to talk to our supervisor who's signing off on our hours? These are really uncomfortable spaces for a lot of us.
Yeah. I mean, you know, as you're saying, do you decide to leave your therapist? I'm like, yes. This person's not for you. This person is not for you.
Right. You know, like, it's okay if they helped you with a lot of stuff, but
we can
always leave our therapist.
Yeah. And I think that's, you know, that goes in, there's this idea, you don't have to stick with the person forever. If, you know, on a human level, if there's such a significant difference in what's affecting you and the way you view the world, you know, yeah, I would say leave. Again, it's, you know, personal decisions, but. And I think, and I, you know, even with colleagues who, you know, from other spaces, people that I went to grad school with and stuff, and I'm able to have conversations. It's very limited. It's a very limited number of people. But this is something that we've discussed. Like, how are you at your site? You know, what are you experiencing? And are you able to bring this issue? And are you able to talk about it? And do you feel supported? And I know at my spaces, I also provide services part-time at a nonprofit clinic, which I trained at in community mental health. But in all spaces I work in, I've been very vocal. And I've received support. And I really appreciate that because I recognize that a lot of people have it. And so what do you, I mean, for me, it was, I can't see myself continuing to be in a space which doesn't align with my value mm-hmm. and the spaces I am do, but I recognize that's not everyone's experience, you know? And so I think even what you were saying earlier about like the student who goes into a class and feels unsupportive, how uncomfortable and how unsafe is it to be in there?
Mm-hmm.
And even for clinicians, like where are your spaces of support?
I think you're bringing up an excellent point of, and perhaps this is a little black and white, and maybe we're getting in the weeds. Maybe I'm getting in the weeds of this thought a little bit too much, but you're pulling me back into the center, which I appreciate. I think that we might find ourselves in very uncomfortable and unsupportive environments, but how do we then find supportive environments? Like, I'm just thinking about how, you know, if you are a therapist who's being supervised by someone who has not checked up on you, who maybe is a Zionist themselves, who, I don't know, hasn't really had empathy or hasn't shown to be an advocate for what's happening around the world. Yes, I totally understand that that would be uncomfortable. And I also recognize that these might be spaces that you can't leave right away. And so how do you find that support elsewhere? I think maybe that's something to think about.
What resources are available and how to access those spaces?
I
was just gonna say, I think about, you know, like social media and or like therapist Facebook groups, or going on, you know, inclusivetherapist.com and taking a look at, you know, who are therapists who, you know, may connect with what you're experiencing as well, and reaching out or creating a network, or, you know, there's a Instagram page. It's the Palm HN Wellness. It's Palestinian mental health and awareness, and, you know, other therapists who through social media are providing support circles for collective healing. And it takes work, right, to get support, to reach out, because as you're saying, like, it's not feasible for everyone to leave where they are or to stop, you know, their training when they're getting their practicum hours.
Mm-hmm.
But how do you provide support for your clients if you're not receiving support yourself?
Right. And where do you find those supports? Are there groups that you can enter, like you said? You had mentioned the experience of being a clinician of color. Can you talk a little bit about that? Because we're in a space where majority of our colleagues are white,
mm-hmm.
and it can be very isolating at times, at least for me, until I found my people.
Mm-hmm.
How has that experience been for you?
As you're saying it was very isolating, I think, especially in the beginning. And because it was, you know, because of the pandemic, I didn't start grad school off in person. Mm-hmm. It moved to online. So that was this further layer of isolation. But it really is an isolating experience. And so when I think of, again, reaching out to those who can provide that community for you within this field, you know, and if you're someone who wants to go into private practice and you're working solely on telehealth, that can also be an isolating experience. But where I trained at is predominantly clinicians of color. And so being able to vocalize that and what I was experiencing in, you know, supervision and perhaps in classes with certain professors was helpful.
As you speak of your experience, I feel like you had so much intention behind some of these major life decisions that you made. There was so much thought that went into these decisions. Like, you chose a specific master's program, perhaps even like the private practice you work at, maybe is predominantly people of color. Is it? Or
mm-hmm.
yeah. I mean, there's just things that there's decisions that you made sure would fill your cup.
Mm-hmm.
And I think so many students, especially BIPOC students, I feel like, I don't know what it is. I don't know if it's a identity thing of no worries. It doesn't matter if this school doesn't have many people that look like me. It's okay if my job only has white people working there.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know what it is, but I almost feel like we think we can just fit in. We can mold ourselves.
That we have to, because we can't have, you know, again, this like aspect of colonization and the way we've been taught, like we have to assimilate or we have to be a certain way, which I think comes across, you know, especially if you're children of immigrants, first gen, second gen, like you have to fit in to this white narrative, and we just don't. We can
It's accepting that, right? Accepting that we just don't.
That we can choose and navigate. And, you know, also, I think, you know, recognizing privilege in this as well, right? That sometimes it really feels, the experience can be that there, it feels like there are no other options. And it takes work to access spaces of inclusivity. But there are more and more.
As you spoke, it made me think about my own experience and feeling so confused.
I think that, like, there's so much newness in this field, right? As you're navigating through. And then, yeah, like, this aspect of, like, who am I? Who am I as a therapist? Who am I as a person? Like, all these layers come in. Because I think about if your personal and your professional values don't overlap, you know, what does that mean for you? How are you showing up authentically as a person, as a professional? And that, like, that identity piece, right? When we're able to have community, which are other therapists, and being able to, like, speak about these things. Like, I don't know where I belong. I don't know where I fit in right now. Nothing is feeling like it's really in alignment. I think this is, you know, those spaces of being getting comfortable with the uncomfortable. You know, I had, while I had, you know, private practice and part-time community mental health, when I started at, for a time, I also got an additional part-time job at it. And it was community mental health, but took more of, like, a private kind of structure and predominantly white. And I was very hesitant. I was like, all right, let me kind of see how this goes. Let me get in some more hours and things like that. And after two supervisions, I decided to leave. Like, it's not for me. And I remember my private practice supervisor saying, how, you know, you decided to leave, because I shared it, of course, and said, oh no, how come you decide to leave? I said, it was too white. I said, enough said, you don't need to explain anything more. And just to have that understanding, you know, that someone, like, understands what your experience, how isolating it can be as a clinician of color, was so validating. That, yeah,
because people don't see it. A lot of people don't see how isolating it really is. And so I guess let me ask you this, like, if you are a practice owner and you are white, how, but if you're a white practice owner, I mean, I've had white practice owners ask me, how do we get more clinicians of color? And I certainly don't know the answer. I don't know if it's our job to figure it out. Yeah, I don't know if it's our job to figure it out. I don't know if that was it's a question that I've been asked. And I sat there and I was like, I don't know, but figure it out.
Yeah. Why put the responsibility onto us?
Right. I mean, perhaps people gravitate to certain, maybe clinicians of color need to know that you're doing the work. And maybe we sense that at interviews and we're like, we're not working for these people or this person. I went on an interview and the practice owner, it was talking about, like, how awesome it is to work with diverse clients. And the practice owner literally asked me, but have you worked with different people? And I'm like, and you and I know what she was asking. She was asking, have I ever worked with white people before? Craziness that happens during interviews.
I don't know. I mean, you know, I've heard clinicians, you know, ask about the way also, like, clients are, can be conceptualized, you know, from a very white lens. I'm like, that's just, I can't, like, this is, no, I won't go into much detail about this, but I think about the place where I stayed for a couple weeks, and I was just like, this is not the space for me.
I sort of love that you just stayed a couple of weeks.
Yeah. I gave it, I think, had I really trusted my gut, I may have left sooner. But there's other factors, right? Coming up into this field as well, you know, whether it be financial, whether it be hours, whether whatever it is. But I was like, how, I sat with myself and I was like, do I want to, it doesn't sit with, I don't know, my morals and values. How can I be at a place where I feel like is contradicting the work, and that, you know, maybe in some ways they are really supporting clients. I believe that is being done. And as a clinician of color, working with predominantly clients of color, this doesn't feel right. And I'm not going to conceptualize clients from, like, a DEI. I have a lot of thoughts and a lot of feelings. It's okay to question things. It's okay to question things. Again, I recognize that there's privilege in having, in creating time and space for yourself to really reflect and to question things. But I believe that growth is necessary, that space is necessary. And we're not taught that we can say no. something in grad school that a professor had said when on like orientation was your relationships are going to change through this time. What I realized along the journey was that the biggest relationship that changed was one with myself and letting go of a lot of people pleasing and other stuff that went on and being okay with saying no.
You know, this idea of saying no, I think we often blame our parents for the inability to say no and have boundaries. But if you look more broadly, we've been conditioned by society to keep your head down, listen to the teacher, even if they insult you, even if they insult your people, to keep your head down, even during an interview where you're asked a kind of insulting question, to keep your head down when you work at a private practice or a community-based organization that has primarily white clinicians and white employees. And I'm really happy that you said that during your experience, you've let go of so much of that.
It becomes suffocating. Who are you living for?
I like to ask this question as we're kind of coming to an end here. And by the way, this conversation was so enlightening. And like, I hope that we continue to keep in touch.
As do I.
For any of the third culture kids that are listening to this, to any of the South Asian Muslim students that are listening to this, what do you feel like they need to know about this field or about entering this field?
You're going to be uncomfortable. You know, isn't that life? So, it's an ongoing journey to being comfortable with making the uncomfortable comfortable. That makes sense. But
so much sense.
Find spaces of support. You know, it again that, you know, some of us therapists were a little more introverted. And again, that might be uncomfortable to reach out, to create a network, to create spaces of support, but it's worth it. You know, we heal through and being able to really access those spaces and people who can support us, like sitting here having a conversation, feeling an opening myself of how wonderful it's been just to sit with you and to talk about some of these things that have been on my mind that I keep within or that I may share with others in certain spaces.
It's healing. Like, oh my gosh, this girl in California actually has had similar experiences to me. I love how you brought this up, though, the feeling of discomfort in our field, because I think oftentimes just as a Pakistani American who has a father who is very much so a perfectionist, I think that in his mind, in order to be a good therapist, although he's not a therapist, right? You have to be perfect in this, right? In order to attract, if you will, clients, you have to be perfect at this. Mm-hmm. And there is no perfection in this. You're constantly learning. Mm-hmm. I mean, every day my clients will say something where I'm like, I need to research this.
Being okay with not knowing, we can't know everything. We're human.
How am I supposed to know everything about the human psyche?
Yeah. You know, someone said to me, this was after I had already graduated. They said, someone from who was Pakistani as well. But you know, how are you going to get clients if you don't have a PhD or like a PsyD? You know, you're not a doctor. How are you going to get clients? No awareness, right? There was no awareness for what it means to be in the field of mental health at this level. Yeah. But that's also the stigma, right? That, well, doctors are experts. And unless you have a PhD or a PsyD, you know, or maybe I'm going off track, but
the newsflash, these doctors aren't experts either. None of us are.
Exactly. And you know, being willing to admit that, you know, that we are constantly learning, we're constantly evolving in ways that we may not have known before. No, we're not going to know. And we're going to make mistakes and we're going to mess up whatever that looks like with our clients. You know, there may be ruptures. How do you fix it? You know, or not how do you fix it, but where's the repair? Where's the repair? Isn't that like, we're human. We're not robots. And we're not, as you're saying, like, we can't. Perfection is an illusion. I think about that so much.
Right? But you are, you know, and I know I'm so sorry because I know that I'm making this seem like we're ending, but I keep bringing up other points.
I'm enjoying the conversation.
But this whole going back to your thing about that, you know, we need to be okay with being uncomfortable and sitting in discomfort. In grad school, there's a lot of dangerous concepts that we learn to be effective, air quotes on the effective therapist, right? I mean, we learn to be blank slates. And what that's really teaching students of today is that you don't have any bias. You're gonna be, that you are as quote unquote perfect as they come, but these things will be tested. Your ideas and your way of seeing the world are going to be questioned, tested, however you want to put it. And you have to be okay with that discomfort that comes, and you have to be okay with stretching and growing in the profession.
One of the books on my reading list currently, which I just started getting into and have been wanting to read for a while, is Decolonizing Therapy by Dr. Jennifer Mullen. So I think this is very important for something to dive into.
Yeah. I need to tap into that book because I think that they actually ask reflective questions as well, which might be good for us and for future therapy. Mm-hmm. Thank you so much, Sahar, for sitting down and talking to me about your experience.
Thank you so much for having me here. Honestly, it's been really wonderful to share space in this way. And I really appreciate what you're doing. I think having a resource like this, you know, being able to listen to other people's journeys and learn from other people's experiences, you know, I imagine if when I was starting out, you know, feeling seen in that way as you're navigating through, it's confusing.
Hard.
Yeah.
It's really hard. But thank you for being so vulnerable and open and sharing some of these things and answering all my questions that are not on the outline. I appreciate you. And I'm sure that those listening to this are going to appreciate you. So thank you.
It's always such a pleasure meeting with various therapists in our field who really take the time to get to know others and the stories that they share. I loved talking to Sahar, and I hope you loved listening to her story. Feel free to connect with her on Instagram at the Chai Circles. If you are someone who is interested in therapy with Sahar, she is currently accepting new clients who live in California. You can reach Sahar at her website, sybtherapy.com. Again, thank you to Sahar, and thank you to all of you who spent some time listening to this episode of Ignite the Change.